transistor is one of those great inventions with many illustrious forebears. From Michael Faraday, more than a century ago, to our three distinguished panelists today, John Bardeen, Walter Bratton, and William Shockley. Because we are going to be discussing the historic development of the transistor, rather than the histories of the individual contributors to the invention, I want to use this introduction for this illustrious triumvirate in the context of solid-state history rather than personal history. In that spirit, perhaps, we should begin by acknowledging what is probably the first significant observation in the semiconductor field, that being Faraday's finding in 1833 that silver sulfide decreased its electrical resistance as its temperature increased. Following Faraday, we find the road to modern solid-state electronics marked with such names as Maxwell, Hertz, Thomson, Lorentz, Bohr, Schrödinger, Dirac, and then in 1931, an important step. A.H. Wilson took all the new theories, Bohr's picture of the planetary atom, the Schrödinger-Dirac quantum wave mechanical theory of matter-energy interactions, and the rest, and applied the new theories to semiconductors. This established the concept that electrons could carry charge either as free negative particles or as free positive holes. Then others extended Wilson's basic theory, including Wilson himself, Mott in England, Yaffe and Davidov in Russia, Seitz in the U.S., and so on. Now we must take a long jump in time to the years just before World War II. William Shockley and Walter Bratton and others were searching for better understanding of semiconductor materials phenomena. And I think it's important to note that these men, who were then at Bell Labs, were searching for that understanding because they thought it would be useful in a signal translating device. Another important name comes into the picture at that time, Mervyn J. Kelly, who was then head of Bell Labs, who was very much concerned about the limitations of electron tube science and technology. With Shockley and James Fisk, among others, there began to develop a stronger feeling that understanding of semiconductor phenomena might lead to innovation that would achieve a new kind of signal translating device that had none of the vacuum tube's intrinsic limitations, heat, and a big appetite for power. They could have this very strong feeling because they had amassed understanding of semiconductor physics and chemistry. The war had interrupted the early exploration at Bell, but in 1945 it was renewed once more at Kelly's direction and under the leadership of James Fisk and William Shockley. By 1946, Bell had about a dozen men working in the area, an interdisciplinary group of physicists, chemists, metallurgists, and engineers. Throughout their work, there was close daily liaison between the theorists, Shockley and Bardeen, and the experimenters, Bratton and Pearson, along with strong support from the metallurgical group. This meant that turnaround time between new theoretical concepts and new critical experiments could be kept to a minimum. I believe this is one of the transistor's most important lessons for us. Another, of course, is the fact that everybody knew what their objective was. And to illustrate this point, I would like to mention that Bill Shockley, a physicist, identified himself in those days as William Shockley, telephone engineer. You can find those words on the patents. Shockley came to Bell in 1936. He'd been a teaching fellow at MIT for the previous 4 years. He received his PhD there in that same year, in 1936, the year that he joined Bell Labs. John Bardeen, on the other hand, was the newest member of the trio. John received his PhD in the same year as Bill Shockley, but he didn't join Bell Labs until 1945, just in time to plunge into the transistor excitement. And in 1946, late that year, he made one of his important contributions to the project with his surface states theory. Shockley earlier had predicted that a perfectly periodic crystal ending in a perfectly pure free surface would have certain energy levels at the surface. Bardeen recognized that if one assumed the existence of energy states at the surface of proper density and energy, then all the puzzling discrepancies between the old theory, such as that of Wilson, Schottky, and others going back all the way back to barrier layer theory, the discrepancies between those theories and actual experiments could be explained. Walter Bratton, the key experimenter in so much of this work, had joined Bell Labs in 1929 and had been there until the early days of the war, when he left to serve in the War Research Division at Columbia University. Then, in 1944, he returned to Bell and soon thereafter was involved in the transistor project. It was through a set of experiments on germanium point contact systems by Bratton and Bardeen that implied that positive holes were flowing in N-type germanium in the vicinity of the point contact. And this, the now historic transistor effect, constituted an entirely new physical phenomenon. I hope this very sketchy introduction helps to set the stage for the afternoon discussions. I'd only like to add this one personal observation about the careers of Bratton, Bardeen, and Shockley, and that is that each of their careers is a blend of what I believe to be the best of both worlds, between the industrial research environment on one hand and the academic environment on the other. You know their career histories too well already to necessitate my reviewing the specifics of the industrial and academic careers of each. So permit me to conclude simply by observing that not only have they had the best of the academic and industrial world, but the academic and industrial worlds have had the best of them. Before proceeding to the discussion, I think it's appropriate that we here recognize the magnitude of the contributions that Drs. Bardeen, Bratton, and Shockley have made to the electronic industry. The invention of the transistor and all of the theoretical understanding that it was built upon and which has come from it has certainly proven to be the cornerstone upon which so much of our industry, and indeed so much of our technological society, is based. 25 years ago, who but a science fiction writer could have foreseen us a revolution in the watch industry, producing the all-electronic watch with 1,200 transistors and LED display and guaranteeing an accuracy of better than 1 minute per year. Or in the calculator industry, a full scientific calculator not much larger than the size of a pack of cigarettes. And the list goes on endlessly. Telemetry, lasers, implanted medical devices. We don't know how many people are alive today as a result of the work these men have done. Gentlemen, we and successive generations are deeply in debt to you, and we salute your contributions to solid-state technology. The Manufacturing Technology Group of IEEE, on behalf of the entire industry, would like, in a very small way, to express thanks through two small gifts, each representing achievements that would have been impossible without your efforts. And I have for each of you a small token, a crystal watch, crystal oscillator watch for each of you, and something that I know every scientist and engineer who doesn't have one wants, one of the Hewlett-Packard scientists. Thank you very much. And now we'll ask Dr. Bratton to talk about the early history.
Hey. The history of semiconductor research, or one history, was written by G.L. Pearson and myself. It was published in the IRE, volume 43, November 12th, December 1955. We have already mentioned that one of the first important phenomena about semiconductors was discovered by Michael Faraday in 1833, the negative temperature coefficient. The next step was the photo-EMF by Becquerel in 1839, and then the photoconductivity by an obscure character who nobody knows, W. Smith, in selenium. F. Braun was the first one to find the rectification effect of point contact. Of course, Hertz came along with his radio waves in 1888. And then G.W. Pierce of Harvard was the first man to insist that the cat's whisker rectifier crystal detector was not a thermal effect. Grundle and Geiger with the copper oxide rectifier, they wanted to make a photocell for railroad signaling. And instead they invented the copper oxide rectifier. Schottky and others used the Hall effect that had been discovered before. We thought electrons were the only conductors, which gave the opportunity for researchers in this area. Schottky and others, his team was working at Siemens in Germany, to use the Hall effect to measure the number of carriers, the sign of the carriers, and the mobility. And the questions of intrinsic and extrinsic conductivity showed up at this time. The next step was, of course, as already mentioned, A.H. Wilson's quantum mechanical model of a semiconductor, which was before solid state was understood, before this time, before the enunciation in 1900 of the two principles, E equals MC squared and E equals H nu, physicists only understood gases from first principles. I might comment just a minute here that all this work up to this time and through to put near the beginning of World War II were done on materials like copper oxide and selenium. And the one reason that more progress wasn't made, this was done all over the world, Russia, Germany, France. I used to have a card file thick with references. But the materials were not the right materials for any progress, and very little progress in real understanding was made in this period. The next step, as far as it happened in the United States, I'm not sure about the other countries, but I knew it had also happened in England, was C.G. Southworth. He was working with microwaves way before his time. Vacuum tubes wouldn't detect the microwaves at his frequency. They wouldn't work at those frequencies. And he was an old radio man. He went over to the Cortlandt Street radio market in New York here and found some old cat's whisker detectors. He blew the dust off and took them out to Homedale and found out they would detect his microwaves. There was a very interesting young man in the group by the name of Ohl, who made the decision to concentrate on silicon. Actually, led's galena, natural crystals that occurred in nature of galena and silicon were the two good materials for this. And actually, galena was a little bit more sensitive than the silicon. But for Ohl, for some reason, which I've never had a chance to explore, decided to concentrate on silicon and asked the metallurgists at the Bell Labs to try to purify the dirty silicon that you could purchase on the market. And Scaff and Thur proceeded on the assumption that most of the impurities in silicon will be more valuable and more volatile than have a higher vapor pressure than the silicon itself, put this raw silicon into quartz tubes, stuck them in a vacuum furnace and heated them up to the melting point, and then let them cool down. And they'd turn these ingots over to Ohl, who had a diamond saw, and he'd cut them down the middle. And he soon found that Scaff and Thur could produce either N or P type. It's an interesting point here. They didn't make the same mistake that Faraday made. They had the right sign for N and P type. Anyway, in one of these ingots, Ohl found, when he started going along with the point on this ingot that had been cut through the cylinder so that he had two half cylinders, that it rectified one way on one end and on the other end another way. And Ohl was working in a laboratory in which there were still ordinary incandescent lights, and he was very quickly aware of the fact that there was some kind of a photo effect in this crystal, and he cut out a little rectilinear part of this, including this boundary, put two contacts on each end of it, and started investigating this photo effect. And I'll never forget the time when we were called, Becker and I, who were supposed to know about semiconductors as research physicists, were called into Kelly's office in around 1940, and this was demonstrated to us. And we were flabbergasted. Ohl had a little pencil flashlight, and when he'd put it across this boundary, realized parallel to the boundary, not perpendicular, not getting the light on the whole surface of the boundary, but just parallel, that this would produce a half a volt, photo EMF, this little flashlight. And Becker and I had never seen anything in front wall or back wall copper oxide or selenium that would produce much more than a hundredth of a volt under these conditions. This was the first PN junction, and this, of course, and the importance of the silicon point contact rectifier and radar. It changed our progress of work. We did a little work before the war. And then we, of course, during the war, you were always put doing something else besides what you did. But there was the war work. Well, first, I should mention the fact that Skaff and Thor came to Becker and I and said that they thought they knew what the important impurities were in silicon. And after having worked with copper oxide, we scoffed at them. We said it couldn't be that simple. But anyway, Skaff and Thor, presumably because of the odor on these ingots after they came out of the oven, which they correlated with the smell of an old automobile carbide lamp, and they traced this odor through the carbide and found out it was phosphorus. And this is the first detection of a fifth column element impurity in a semiconductor at concentrations below spectroscopic detection at that time. The war work, Skaff and Thor stayed with it. Locke Horowitz and his group at Purdue, Benzer and Bray, and the MIT work carried the work on during the war. It was at that time, of course, all secret and classified in this situation. After the war came the fact that the contact potential between P and N. Oh, I missed one point. I think I'm doing all right on time. I missed one point in the Mott-Schottky space charge, a theory of rectification in 1939. Gave us the first real theory that came anywhere near explaining rectification. This theory, of course, would predict that there should be a contact potential between N and P-type silicon, for example, of near 1 volt. But you didn't find it, as Meyerhoff first did at the University of Pennsylvania in 1943, I think it was, or 40. No, it was a little late, 1947 it was. And then Benzer at Purdue found that in investigating germanium, he made pieces of germanium and wedges so he could make contact between an N and P-type germanium. When he did, he got rectification. He also made a germanium wedge that was so highly doped that it's practically metallic. And when he put that on one, he'd get one IV curve. And when he put it on the other, he'd get the other IV curve. And he found that those IV curves were the reverse curves of the two samples of germanium when they were rectified. And that is the end of, I brought the up as far as I'm going to go.
Before we continue with the discussion of the history, from a technical point of view, we'd like to hear Bill Shockley talk a little bit about how the work was organized. And I, for one, am particularly interested in his comments because I know how much is claimed today regarding the scientific management of research. And I also know the discrepancy between the claims and what happens in most places.
Bill? Well, I'd like to start this story of the history back quite a bit further, and I'm going to overlap with some of the interests that Walter and I had. I'd rather forgotten about this particular notebook entry, which you see is the 29th of February, 1940. I'd always wondered why I didn't celebrate something I intended on the 29th of February, 1940, which I'll tell you about. But that shows a piece of copper oxide with lying on copper with two electrodes on it, and it shows current flowing from one of the metal stripes to the other one. This is in effect a junction, a Schottky barrier field effect transistor with the copper working under it. Now let's have the next slide on this, which I notice that this one is signed on this 29th of February by Shockley and Bratton. There'd been an earlier entry back in December, I think it was, with much less straightforward geometry. I don't remember the circumstances of this, Walter, but I suspect that what happened was that you said this would be a better geometry to use than the earlier one I was proposing, which was sort of putting a grid in there.
Let me make just one comment. Shockley comes into my office as the man who knew how to get copper oxide in special forms, told me that he had an idea of how to make an amplifier. I laughed at him because Becker and I had been through this and all this, and I said, but I don't think it'll work. but it's so damned important that I'll try to make have the copper oxide made the way you want.
That was the earlier one. We got no effect on that. And actually, within the last 6 months, I've tried to see if we'd get any effect on a thing rather like this,
and that didn't work out either.
This was the background idea and some of the interest, and I might say something about management in respect to that, because one of the provoking things, from my point of view, was a conversation I had with Mervyn Kelly. That's incorrect. Was a talk I remember Mervyn Kelly giving me. And Mervyn Kelly's gave me a long pep talk, as Mr. Trebus has said, along the lines, that we ought to get the relays out of the telephone exchanges. I'm not so sure you were right on the fact that he didn't want to get the vacuum tube out, because he was then just moved up to research director from heading the vacuum tube department, and I think maybe he had hopes of doing it with vacuum tubes. But I'd done solid-state physics, theoretical physics, under John Slater at MIT, and I got disenchanted with the vacuum tube department, and went back to to work on solid-state things, and that's where Walter and I got together. But at any rate, there was the idea of, can one make something which will amplify? And it takes too long to talk about other things we tried, some of which must have been tried by other people 30 years earlier. But at any rate, at the end of the war, when I was in the Pentagon working in operations research business, Mervyn Kelly foresaw the end of the war. Germany had already folded up, was about to fold up. And he brought me back to talk about organizing this solid-state group and took me to Homedale, where one of the men who worked under Southworth, R.S. Ohl, O-H-L, was his name, and Ohl had been working with point-contact rectifiers in connection with radar, but he had found a negative resistance in these, which I think we conjecture was a thermal effect. And it actually built a radio set which used this negative resistance to produce amplification, so it could play through a small loudspeaker with no tubes, whatever. And this obviously was a great promise and was one of the things that that Kelly emphasized. So when we, when the solid-state group was organized, this was one of the important things that we had in mind getting after. Also, at that time, I was not uniquely the theoretical physicist in the physical research department at Bell Labs, but I guess I was probably the only one who'd actually been trained in the, so to speak, quantum physics of solids. That's probably right, wasn't it, Walter?
Yes.
And had the notion that we'd need more strength in this area, and so I was one of the main contacts in inducing John Bardeen to come and look us over and get in there. We had several divisions in this group. Kelly had divided the responsibility between me and a physical chemist, S.O. Morgan. S.O. Morgan, the technical contribution, I think, of S.O. Morgan was a patent of his with someone else. He was perhaps the first person who had ever made practical use of an isotope to change an electrical property. He had a patent on changing the properties of some piezoelectric crystal Rochelle salt, maybe by replacing ordinary hydrogen by heavy hydrogen. And this would push the temperature of the ferroelectric Curie point around and alter its properties. And we had magnetics, piezoelectrics, dielectrics, and I say magnetism, and semiconductors. Any interest in ferroelectrics came in somewhat later. Well, the Bell Labs, in operating a research group of this sort, would specify an area in which work would be done. Beyond that, our hands were very free. Nobody could tell us from outside what to do. If they came with a good request for something, I remember one of the first things we would respond to it. I remember one of the things I did even before I came back from the Pentagon, when I was making just short-term visits, was to have a long do a survey on the statistics of copper oxide, and that was brought up by J.R. Wilson, who was concerned with the problems of manufacturing copper oxide rectifiers for click reducers or other things in the telephone plant. So that was the sort of framework, but in this we could do work on those things we wanted. I recall one time at which we were doing things, perhaps John's work on surface states or some other things with silicon and germanium, which we'd picked as being the right materials to work on, and someone coming in and saying, look, you know, we're trying to do things with nickel oxide. this is, we've got some other semiconductors that are of great technical importance in the telephone company. You really ought to be working on those. And I recall taking, having no enthusiasm for this whatever. Another thing I didn't develop any enthusiasm for was selenium. That was perhaps one of my better pieces of judgment, or maybe somebody else pushed me into that, but that was an important thing. Does that, do you think that gives a feel for what I can say more, or maybe you have a point to ask or observation to make?
No, I think we should move on because we are planning to save time for an interaction with the audience, and if there are people in the audience who want to ask you a specific question, I'd rather leave them the time. Now we come to a view of theory and the scientific background by the only man I know who potentially could win a third Nobel Prize, Dr. Bardeen.
Well, the only reason for that last remark is because I have two.
A good reason.
As Bill Shockley said, I joined the Solid State Research Group just after the end of the war in the fall of 1945. I had been on leave during the war from an academic post at the University of Minnesota, and my salary on leave had hardly increased at all, and my family had increased by a factor of three or so, and so I really couldn't afford to go back. And I'd known Jim Fisk and Bill Shockley from the days I'd spent at Harvard in the 30s, and sounded like a very interesting work at the Bell Labs, although I had no idea at that time what branch of solid-state physics I might work in. Bill said I was free to look around and decide, work on whatever I wanted to, and that looked like a very good proposition to me. Things were rather crowded at that time because they still had an influx of people finishing up their wartime projects. And a new building was being built at Murray Hill, but it wasn't completed yet. So I was put in an office with Walter Bratton and Gerald Pearson. And although I did study some other aspects of solid-state physics, dielectrics, and so on, what I heard most about was semiconductors from Gerald and Walter, and gradually got interested in that field. And I think the first paper, which was a joint paper between the three of us, was to try to interpret some data Walter had taken before the war on the oxidation of copper. He'd measured the rate of growth of the oxide and worked out a theory of this that seemed to check the experiments pretty well. So this was our first paper, and it ties in with the sort of work which was done in the 30s and not the work we were going to be doing in the late 40s, because we soon decided that to work on germanium and silicon primarily, because a great deal of work had been done on these materials during the war, so a great deal was known about them, and they could be obtained in fairly pure form for those days, not according to present standards, of course. It was all polycrystalline material. One of the aims was to try to get a more thorough understanding of the bulk properties, and Gerald Pearson took the lead in this, so together with the metallurgy group, in having quite a number of samples of silicon made with various concentrations of group 3 and group 5 impurities, and then measured the Hall effect and conductivity over a range of temperatures, and try to interpret this in a quantitative way as well as possible. One of the difficulties with the experiments done in the 30s is it was very difficult to get a good correlation between theory and experiment. The semiconductors were what people call structure sensitive, and what you'd measure would depend on just how the
particular sample was made, and it was very hard to get reproducible results. But we hoped that by making a very complete study, we would be able to get a good correlation between theory and experiment. And Gerald and I later did publish a joint paper on these results, which did establish what was thought to be true, that group 3 impurities in germanium and silicon are acceptors, and group 5 are donors. This was thought, but that it hadn't definitely been proved until these experiments were carried out. And another important thing is what Bill Schottky just mentioned, is the field effect as a possible way of making an amplifying device with a semiconductor, that this would be a great breakthrough if this could be done. And first tried doing it with deposited thin films of germanium and silicon, and this was without success. I didn't seem to show any effect. And then got the idea that perhaps the charge induced on the surface doesn't go in the space charge layer, Schottky space charge layer, as had been thought might happen, but was tied up in fixed positions for electrons on the surface states. And if you accept this picture of surface states, then you could have a Schottky space charge barrier at a free surface, even though you applied no field. And you could even have an inversion layer of, say, N-type in the bulk of the material changing to P-type at the surface. And by applying fields, well, it's getting ahead of the story, but in any case, with surface states, could account for a number of experiments, one of which was that the contact potential or work function didn't seem to be dependent on doping of the semiconductor as you move the Fermi level up and down in the interior. With doping, you might think that the work function would change, but this was found not to be the case. And apparently it was because the work function was fixed by the surface states and not by what was inside the semiconductor. Well, one experiment was suggested by Bill, I think, and carried out by Walter, was to measure the contact potential with some very heavily doped specimens. And there they did find a change in contact potential, because with very heavily doped specimens, you could overwhelm the surface states and even get a little idea of the density of surface states on the surface. But a very important way of studying surface barriers is by studying the change in contact potential with light. And this is one of the key experiments which was done. And this was done first primarily just to try to understand what was going on at the surface. Frankel had earlier worked out a theory of this effect. And in fact, in working out the theory, he gave all of the equations we now use to describe the flow of electrons and holes in a semiconductor when the concentration of electrons and holes is not in equilibrium, including diffusion terms and so on. So that this experiment on change in contact potentials with light is not only an important way of learning about the surface barrier, but also gave the proper equations to use to understand later on flow across PN junctions and transistors and so on. I guess perhaps you could take a story up from here, since Walter, since it was you and Bob Gibney who
well, is
first
this,
showed that
is
you
this
could.
Part of yours?
Well, was that critical November 17th
date? Right up to that date, yeah.
Well,
getting close to it.
One of the experiments that we tried, and I'd like to emphasize right here that there were a whole series of experiments from here on that were done for a reason. But the reason was not important after we did the experiment. And the first one of these was the idea of seeing if we could measure a temperature coefficient of this space charge layer by contact potential method. And being a rough and ready physicist, I fixed up a contact potential apparatus that I could stick in a glass tube and put in a thermos bottle, and I proceeded to cool this thing down to liquid air temperatures and back up to room temperature and to plot up. I got a big change in contact potential, but when I plotted the curve, it was a great big hysteresis curve, and it was pretty obvious that working in a humid laboratory in August, that the moisture had all condensed on the glass wall when I cooled it down and all condensed on the semiconductor surfaces I warmed it up, and that this was just a moisture effect in changing the surface potential and not a temperature effect. So the next thing I thought of in this was to try to eliminate this effect by immersing this semiconductor in a liquid before I varied the temperature to try to equilibrate what was going on the surface. And I experimented, both being an innocent physicist and not a chemist, with both electrolytes and dielectrics. And I tried them out first at room temperature just by squirting with an eyedropper a little bit in between the reference electrode and the semiconductor, and I found that I got tremendous changes in photo EMF. And finally, with Gibney's help, I showed this to everybody in the whole darn group, trying to get some help in understanding what I was seeing, and they'd come in and look at it and then walk away in a little while, shaking their heads. But finally, Gibney came in and looked at it, and he said, well, you've got a potential in this circuit. I always had a balancing potential for the contact potential. And that day, we varied the potential. He said, let's vary it, and we varied it. And that day, we showed that with an electrolyte, we could make the photo effect become very large at one extreme, come down as we varied the potential on the electrolyte to zero, change its sign, and go the other way. In other words, as Bill knows, we had, in essence, produced his field effect using an electrolyte as a contact to a semiconductor.
So I could take on the story a little bit from there, or perhaps should step back a moment, that we had tried observing the field effect on these deposited thin films by cooling them down, hoping to freeze the electrons in the surface state so when the field was applied, you'd observe a field effect. And this experiment did work. We did observe a field effect, but it was down by orders of magnitude from what you'd expect from what we knew the bulk mobility of the carriers was. That is, the mobile induced charge in these deposited thin films had very low mobility, and this is one of the difficulties with these deposited thin films. And so I thought we should, after hearing about these experiments of Walter Broughton and Bob Gibney, that we shouldn't try to observe the field effect in deposited films, but in bulk material. And talking with Walter, thought that perhaps a useful geometry would be one where you can find the flow of carriers near the surface with a p-n junction rather than by using a true thin film, so that you would be able to swing the bands up and down in the bulk material, as is evident from the experiment which Walter and Bob Gibney carried out. But at the same time, you just have the very thin inversion layer on the surface. And Walter remembered some early experiments of Ohl, which seemed to indicate that if you had P-type silicon, as I recall, that there was a thin N layer on the surface if it was prepared in the right way. And so suggested the geometry of insulating a point contact to the surface of the silicon, and then it would be a rectifying contact. But a large part of the current in the reverse direction would be flowing through this inversion layer near the surface. And we should be able to affect that by applying a transverse field to the surface and thus get a field effect. And we tried this experiment. It worked the first time. And of course, we're very elated with that. And then we decided to go try it with germanium, although we didn't have any firm idea that it would work in germanium. We tried it with N-type germanium, and sure enough, there was evidence for a P-type layer on the N-type germanium. And putting a point contact on the surface and then surrounding it with the electrolyte and applying a voltage to the electrolyte, you could change the current in the reverse direction to the point contact in such a way as to get an amplifier. But this would only work at very low frequencies. And obviously, the reason was the long time constant associated with the motion of ions in the electrolyte. And so we wanted to replace the electrolyte with what now is an MOS device, as we wanted to produce an oxide on the surface and then deposit a film over the oxide and then hope to get the field effect through a thin oxide layer and thus have it operate at much higher frequencies. But something went wrong with putting the metal down. It wasn't insulating as we'd hoped, but I thought, well, might as well try it anyway. And when we tried it, we discovered that its effect in the opposite direction than the field effect would give. And we discovered that applying a positive voltage to what's the emitter, you'd induce holes to flow on the surface to the collector in such a way as to produce amplification.
Can I put in one comment here? Just one. We saw, and we biased the electrolyte so that the germanium was being anodized. And we saw the outside film. And we thought we'd use that to put the gold on top. But when we washed off the electrolyte, germanium oxide is soluble in water, and we washed off the oxide too, and we put the gold down on a freshly anodized surface of germanium, which is the best surface treatment there is for germanium, as we found out later.
But in any case, this experiment was done with this gold spot, and that looking at the models of the first transistor, I can see it was the same piece of germanium that was used in some of our earlier experiments with the electrolyte. But this is the first observation of what's now called the transistor effect, the fact that you can control the conductivity of a semiconductor by current flow from an appropriate contact rather than by a field effect or by a photo effect or something of that sort, as we found a new way of controlling the conductivity of a semiconductor. And this is the key to the first the point contact transistor. And then when Bill was, initially we weren't sure how important this inversion layer was on the surface, other than we knew it was the basis for getting holes to flow into the N-type germanium, but we weren't sure just how the holes flowed across the surface to the collector contact, whether they were primarily through the surface layer went the bulk of the germanium. And Bill Shockley suggested what's now the junction transistor geometry in order to first just understand what was going on in the point contact transistor, but he soon realized that it would be a fine transistor in its own right. I think that that probably concludes the story as far as I'm aware.
I want to make one other comment here. This group was one of the greatest research groups and teams that I ever worked with. And this, when a discovery like Gibney's and mine was made, we immediately call a conference any time of the day. The space charge was discussed when Bardeen first presented that with the whole group. And it was in this group many times that the ideas for the next experiments were suggested in the discussion in the group. And this was an essential part of all this work.
And we also had many seminars reviewing the early literature in semiconductors and what had been done during the war. So it was an extremely inspiring and educational experience to be there.
Now, Bill, we have you scheduled to talk about the process as it occurred from here on, and I hope, as you describe this, you will give us a chance to share with you, to relive with you, that sense of excitement that occurred when you realized what you knew.
Well, this is an area which I have worked on as much as a research job as I am from memory. It's a mixture of the two things. When the laboratories decided to establish the fact that the transistor was originated at Bell Laboratories and not necessarily with Sony, distinguishing, this divides the problem, distinguishing between the original creation you see and the education, but that's the area of somebody else's discussion today. So I'll leave that one. But at any rate, I did some looking into history, and that slide that I'm going to bring on in a moment was part of this. And I have talked on the, given talks on the transistor, and I'd like to read a little bit of an abstract I wrote at one time, which I remarked on some of these things that happened. One, there's a key date which both Walter and John have talked about, the date of this application of voltage to the electrolyte, and that's on this this slide. But there's another date which I look at with mixed emotions, and that's the 23rd of January, 1948. That was the date at which I first realized that injection across a p-n junction into across an emitter junction, so as to produce collection at a collector junction, was obviously a good thing. And it baffles me that it took as long as it did, because if I look over notebook entries, which I'm not going to show you, all sorts of, I'd drawn pictures like that, things very close to this, and it calculated diffusion in a p-n junction, the diffusion current, but only for the reverse direction. Of course, the mathematics is there. And I'd also thought about making things of a number of layers, which you might use as lightning arresters by applying large voltage so that you'd pull down the hill and the carriage would go straight through. But this notion of injection in respect to the transistor action didn't come about until, as John was saying, the question was, what was going on with these with the point contact transistor, trying to see if we couldn't design some physics that would really clarify just what the effect was. Well, when I went back and looked at this, I got out notebooks. We're pretty meticulous about keeping notebooks. They're all filed in a repository about 10 miles from the Murray Hill Laboratory. And so I had a whole file drawer full of notebooks back in September. And then I went through and produced this slide. I got the data for this slide. This leads up to the 17th of November. And this is the what I call the period of quiet, calm deliberation. And the reason I say that is because it ties in with that February 29th, 1940 date that I would say that I was puzzled about what was going on there, because I had for a long time intended to celebrate a birthday on that date. That happens to be the 21st birthday of Frederick, who was indentured to the pirates and the Pirates of Penzance. You recall, he was indentured not until he was 20 years old, but until he reached his 21st birthday. And when he had gotten to be 21 years old, he hated pirates and he was going to become a policeman. And the pirate captain pointed out that the terms of the agreement were 21st birthday, which had not come until 1940. Which happens to be just exactly the date that Walter and I signed that earlier disclosure there. Well, anyhow, this November 17th is an important date there, and this shows what I describe in terms of another part, I think it was from the pirates, or maybe the gondoliers, which is goes under the heading of quiet, calm deliberation. I'll explain that a little more fully in a moment. But what I did was to go and look up notebooks for about a year earlier, maybe 1946 and 47, and found out the average number of pages per month used in those notebooks. Now, as a theoretician, John would have occasion, only occasions to put down things he thought were of historical significance in a notebook. 1946, he'd been doing more, obviously, than he had up to this date in 47. Walter, of course, recorded his experimental data, because that was the best way to keep it. And I would write down some ideas I thought might be inventing and so on down there. Well, now could I just for a moment have the lights on, because I want to talk about this quiet, calm deliberation, which in the Gilbert and Sullivan thing, this is described in one of these patter songs that goes on, quiet, calm deliberation disentangles every knot. And this is the this is what I want to demonstrate, that the quiet, calm deliberation can indeed disentangle every knot. I want to point out that, and there's a critical period in there, which is 17 November to 24 December, because 24 December is the date of this famous notebook entry of Walter Bratton's that's been reproduced in many places. But what did the notebook look like on November 17th? And that's the next slide. Now, you may not, so I'd like that now, yeah. Here Walter says, this shows what he was doing. There's a piece of P-type silicon with the plate opposite to it, and he was shining light on it. But he says, in showing these effects to Gibney, he suggested that I vary the DC bias on the circuit while observing the light effect. It was found with distilled water, alcohol, and acetone that a plus potential is shown increased the effect, and opposite potential reduced the effect to almost zero. In this slide, you see this block at the middle of the bottom there. New experimental conditions, new facts. And you can see how quickly ideas went on by looking at the... one of the things, at this point, we had this practical result, the transistor, I think, in the back of everybody's head. Once the field was evidently getting through the surface, then, at once, that target that had been forgotten about, or latest, it hadn't been forgotten about, it had been put aside. It wasn't the direct aim. Once that happened, they were at once after it. So the next slide shows the end of a notebook entry signed by Gibney and Bratton on the 20th of November, 3 days after that experiment, you see. And witnessed by John Bardeen and Burke Moore, who was an electrical engineer, who had helped with the measurements in that group. And it says it's, of course, evident that the liquid dielectric could be replaced by a solid dielectric if one could be found having the proper ionic mobility to form a dipole layer at the surface of the semiconductor. So there's a patentable idea. And the next slide shows one of the effects which worked. That's the drop of electrolyte with a point contact coming in from the left, touching the semiconductor, and a ring embedded in the electrolyte, which you can't see, which puts voltage on the electrolyte. The next slide shows the patent drawing of that. And one of the ways I describe this this talk is to say a tale of five patents, because there were five patents filed on transistor structures prior to the time of the public announcement. And this, I think, was perhaps the first disclosure. Four of these patents were filed in February of 1948, and one was abandoned and continued and filed in June of 48, and so was the junction transistor application. The next shows what John Bardeen has been talking about. This, he may not remember the dates, but here they are. This was a weekend, as I recall. It was the 23rd of November, and I think he spent most of that weekend at home writing in his notebook. And this shows the concept of the thin inversion surface layer and a point contact in that, and the current flowing out in the thin layer when the when current is being carried by electrons in the layer. They would then be flowing to the positive point, and the junction would be reverse biased, whereas with the opposite polarity, the p-n junction would be biased forward, and there'd be much less resistance. Then with this, next slide now, shows his drawings on what amounts to an insulated gate field effect transistor working on an inversion layer. And I don't know at that time, this is essentially an MOS field effect transistor. What is really different about it, John? Would you say?
I think it's essentially that, you know, only make idea was to make use of the inversion layer at the surface to get the thin layer with the inversion layer at the surface. I think it's essentially the same.
And nothing in particular overcoming surface states here, except that you now knew you could get through them with the electrolyte.
That's right.
Well, and I think the next slide is the patent drawing on that particular thing. Now let's see. I've collected these. This is sort of a look at more details of the history that went on. There are a couple of other interesting points, I think. The next one. This I found, this December 4th entry, to be a particularly telling one. Walter wrote down, he says, I was out due to a cold. The experiment immediately above was taken over by Pearson. That's an earlier page of the notebook. Anyway, the experiment worked. He gives a Pearson entry. At a conference on November 22nd or 29th, so let's take a little looking back on, well, it couldn't have been the 29th. Well, let's see. No, this is December 4th. Well, it was decided that all the following combinations should be tried. And the first one shows this one that I've just resulted in, the Gibney-Bratton patent, the first clearly defined conception. And then the second one is one that I had proposed and plays a very central role in the junction transistor patent for patent reasons that I'm not sure I really understood until I was doing research on this. But what this shows is a p-n junction with a drop of electrolyte on it. And we found that worked, and that gave actually power gain. The electrolyte altered the reverse current across that p-n junction. You apply voltage to the electrolyte. I think we didn't really have any idea how it worked. This was part of the floundering around business that went on. However, if I could, I think it'll take a little too long to run the slide that shows the patent claim. But the patent claim on the junction transistor, patent claims, had some of the broadest of any of the claims, and the one Sony has devised this so that it sings to you in a Japanese accent there, you see, at the time we get to the end of the tape. Well, the junction transistor patent comprises a block of semiconductor having a barrier and means of making current flow across that barrier. In other words, a voltage applied between the base and the collector, and independent means for varying the impedance of the barrier. It was just about that broad. So the independent means could be an emitter junction, which was also disclosed in this three-layer junction transistor patent. But this blob of electrolyte was also disclosed, and that claim which says independent means of controlling the resistance of the barrier works equally well for the electrolyte as it does for the emitter junction. So the patent was reduced to practice prior to filing, and it did teach how to do it, but it disclosed various other ways of doing it besides the one way, which involved the glycol borate. Nobody's mentioned glycol borate, I think, in this discussion, but that was a great a very important magical media that were used in those days and was readily available in laboratories by virtue of the fact that it was used in electrolytic condensers.
Let me make one comment.
Let me just tell how we get to water, which was with a standard method of getting glycol borate under those conditions, which required certain other elementary laboratory apparatus consisting of a hammer, a nail, and a vise.
The first electrolyte used in these early experiments was water. But the drop of water would evaporate just about the time things got interesting. And we asked Gibney for a better electrolyte. and he gave us a glycoborate mixture with some other borate in it at the time that was used in electrolytic condensers. And when that one slide with the point and the drop on there, that was a simulation long time afterwards of that experiment, but we couldn't find the glycoborate that was pure enough then to reproduce what we'd actually done, because they weren't using purified glycoborate for electrolytic condensers anymore.
Well, fortunately, that was an art which the transistor technology was able to advance beyond. Well, let's see what the next slide is. Oh, heaven's sakes, there was the claim. I'd forgotten I had it at that point. But that's it. It says, an electrical translating device comprising a body of semiconductive material having two zones of unlike conductivity type separated by a barrier. Means for establishing current flow between said two zones and means separate from said first means for controlling the impedance to current flow introduced by said barrier. And so that reads equally well on this glycoborite item or the proper junction transistor. Now the next one.
Well, this is a very key entry, and this shows something about the interaction in the group. And it's going to bear on something I started to read in this abstract, which says, in respect to the injection being 23 January, earlier than this, the use of a reverse bias PN junction for voltage gain was recognized on 8 December 1947 in a very half-baked disclosure. That's not this one. That's the one in my notebook that I'll come to in a moment. Thus, review of notebook history reveals that the foundations of transistor electronics were created by floundering around as much as by pure inspiration. Perhaps that's what pure inspiration really is. Now, I'm not sure floundering around is exactly the right description, but maybe the panel will argue about this in due course. But the title I gave for this talk was Creative Failure Methodology, the Invention of the Transistor. Creative failure methodology, you see, and the failure of the thin layer field effect transistor, that became a creative contribution of John Bardeen, who started from that with surface states and then found that they explained all these other things. So I have a notion that if you can persuade people or you can convince people that the really important things weren't necessarily done by going straight down the line from formulate the problem, make hypotheses, get results, you see, and so on, but is done by trying to find out what the problem is and getting familiar with things, one may actually increase creativity. So I wrote, creative failure methodology is intended to stimulate creativity by showing that failures need not be simply accepted as causes of low self-esteem, but can instead be used as stepping stones on the path to creativity. Well, thank you. I wasn't sure. I mean, I can sermonize given the least excuse, but anyway, here's what Walter and John signed on the 8th of December. They say, that's a voltage amplification of 2 and a power amplification, giving a power amplification of 330. This is one of the first ones I found, Walter, with a real clean-cut big figure of gain on it. Then he says, note, the above result or experiment was started as a result of a luncheon discussion with Shockley and Bardeen, and the final suggestion of Bardeen that voltage amplification could be obtained, the above experiment was performed on high back voltage germanium, which is highly purified, stands high reverse bias. Well, there's some other notebook entries here which tie in with this. So let's go back. Let's go to the next slide now. We were enthusiastic about conversion of materials at that time and making layers. And here's an NPN, but that's not a junction transistor. That's a junction field effect transistor. As far as I know, that's the first drawing of a junction field effect transistor. And it points out that no surfaces to affect the interaction between the control and the P region. Nothing. Let's go on now. Let's go on to the next slide. And this was a voltage amplification idea, and this is the really half-baked one. Well, that's the one we talked about at lunch. And this says, let's get a big PN junction and put on drops of glycol, very wide one, maybe widen it out by diffusion, and put drops of glycoborate at various places on that so they wouldn't extend very far over it. And then each one of them could somehow change the current. Now, we didn't have any idea how that was changing the current. I think almost certainly it was doing it by producing surface channels off on the sides of the junction, but that we probably didn't know until 2 years later. So this was a thorough flounder around operation. And the next slide shows the next page on that, which has an 8 December date. And and makes remarks that afterwards that I discussed this with Walter Bratton and John Bardeen at lunch today after JMR, who was J.M. Richardson's Journal Club talk. And then apparently I showed this to Bardeen to tie it down on the 10th of December. So you see how I think almost certainly the lunch discussion there was, here's this PN Junction thing, which was in itself a miserable, that was a flounder round. And then John says, let's use the high back voltage, and there was the power gain. But that high back voltage was not yet the point contact transistor. That was with the electrolyte. Well, let's see what the next one is. Oh, the next one is a disclosure of Gibney's. There were altogether these five patents. There was the, in terms of disclosure, the first one of Bratton and Gibney, and then one of Bardeen's of the insulated gate, and then there was the point contact of Bardeen and Bratton. And then this was the fourth one of the ones that was filed at that time, and that's Gibney talking about how to use an electrolyte to affect the surface. Now, when you look at this patent situation in this time, you wonder that Gibney has appeared so little in the description of what went on, and there were a couple of factors that involved this. I talked to Gibney last September to find out what had gone on. I couldn't remember. I'm quite sure I'd had to do with recruiting him into the group as a chemist who'd be able to add the chemistry to the sorts of things that Walter was working on. He was with us for, I think, nearly a couple of years. But so I called up Gibney and I asked him, after due course, did you leave? He's Los Alamos. He went to Los Alamos about this time. Did you leave because you felt you'd been sort of neglected, not emphasized on this? Oh, no, he said, Bill, that wasn't the reason. It was the New Jersey winters. But I have the lights on for a moment now, because I see in the way I started into this, I didn't say, I didn't give a basis for this phrase, the will to think. And that Fermi reminds me of that, because I have two phrases to mention from Fermi. In about 1941, or 40, we had been asked to look into nuclear reactors, or look into the use of fission for war. And Fermi was working at Columbia and was going to work on the pile, although we didn't know that. But Jim Fisk and I were asked to work on this. We actually independently invented the moderator scheme, and in due course a patent was filed on this, which was finally abandoned. And in the course of this, I visited Fermi, and Fermi used that phrase. And he used it in a very interesting and telling way, which I was impressed with and have repeated since. They knew then the Manhattan Project was going to get started. They would have lots of money to do experiments. They would have funds. They were busy doing calculations on what's the best way to do experiments for a nuclear reactor. And Fermi's remark about that, now that they were doing these calculations, trying to get the best designs for doing this sort of thing, now that this had come along, they knew they'd get supported, this gave them the will to think. See, you knew something would happen. And I think that thing comes up frequently. Now, there's, the other thing I should mention about Fermi, you'll find referred to, but I doubt if anybody's noticed the credit line, but this is in the first Physical Review Junction Transistor paper by Shockley, Sparks, and Teal. And in that, I introduce this thing, the IMRAP, for the quasi-Fermi level. And I have a footnote on that, which says that that this name was suggested by the most appropriate authority who suggested. And the way that came about was, I was this later date in the transistor days, happened to be talking to Fermi at a physical society meeting in Chicago, and I said, what should you call this thing? Quasi-Fermi level is too long. He said, well, you might call it an IMRAP. And this didn't mean anything to me until about 10 minutes later when I spelled it backwards, you see. But that's where it came from. So I thought that would entertain you. But now I think I've just about used up what time you think I have on this, haven't I?
Other questions? Yes, sir?
There are many people that discount the experimental with respect to the purely mathematical analytical. How long do you think it would have taken you to make the solution to this approach by the direct, straightforward mathematical analytic method?
Well, I think this whole field has required a very close interplay of theory and experiment. There was a big gap between theory and experiment in the 30s. not because the theories were incorrect, but because we didn't have materials which were being worked on, mainly copper oxide and selenium, are both difficult to understand, difficult to control the properties. We happened to come along at a very opportune time to be able to work with germanium and silicon. And even there, it's taken many years to learn how to control the properties to the required degree to make good transistors. We first worked on germanium, not because we thought that was the best material, because it was easier to purify than silicon. It took many years before we were able to make good transistors with silicon. And this is requires excellent metallurgy and a great deal of original thought and how to process materials. It's not obvious at all, as you can draw structures on paper and hope they will work, but they won't work, particularly with semiconductors, unless you're able to prepare exceptionally pure materials or put the impurities that control their properties in just the right places.
One of the biggest decisions that was made in the first meeting of this group was what was the reason why not more understanding in the years from 1930 on, before World War II, had not contributed to an understanding of semiconductors. And that was that the materials that everybody's working with were very dirty, complicated, and so on and so forth. And it became immediately obvious that silicon and germanium were solids of elements in which the impurities in it, if any, would have to be a different element. They were also materials that were, the crystal was a diamond bond, the simple hydrogen covalent bond that quantum mechanics gave us an understanding of. A bond that was so strong there couldn't be missing places in the lattice. That the impurities were probably, at least the main ones, the third and fifth column were substitutional impurities, which was one of the experiments we performed in the group to prove that this was so. And we made the decision right then to try to understand these two. And I spent the rest of my professional life at the Bell Labs trying to understand the germanium surface.
I'd like the panel to comment on another part of this history that I personally had a lot of dealings with. Jack Morton was very helpful to the University of Michigan and to Motorola through his cohorts in getting started, getting this technology spread throughout the country. The seminars that were held at various campuses, the need for teachers of solid state, the need for engineering, and companies like those new ones that Dr. Burroughs had mentioned, getting into the business. We had to depend on the teaching of, well, as Jack used to call it, the Bell Labs Graduate School. I'd like to know from your side what overt efforts were made back there to really help educate the whole country.
Your question reminds me of one related topic that I think is of enough interest and is close enough to be worth mentioning, and that's a discussion that I know went on prior to the announcement of the transistor publicly. And there was an interesting aspect of this. It was held about roughly 7 months. The thing that there'd been an experience at Bell Labs, which I had thought might have had quite a substantial influence on determining the timing that was involved. Actually, I found out in talking later, that's my recollection rather than the truth of the situation, but the experience had occurred in respect to work done on waveguides, at which time the most advanced group in the world was almost certainly the Crawford Hill or Holmdel, as I certainly always called it at the time, under Southworth's direction. But W.L. Barrow, or Zeke Barrow as he was called, up at MIT, and someone else had submitted a paper on called Electromagnetic Propagation Down Hollow Pipes. That paper came to Bell Labs for refereeing, and I don't know the exact details, but somehow maybe the Bell System Technical Journal came out first. And this had obviously been provoked by this manuscript in the IRE. This produced a very disagreeable impression. all around. And I know people talking about saying we wouldn't like to have anything like this happen with the transistor. But I don't think in reviewing this with other people who were involved in conferences and deciding when the release should be, that wasn't an important factor. But I think generally the feeling was that it was both important to the to Bell Labs' reputation to do what they could to help in this. Also, there'd be flow back in terms of development in other places. That what went on there due to patent agreements and so on would undoubtedly feed back. And furthermore, things done that affected the universities would put the laboratories in an improved position on recruiting. There were all of these things that fitted into the, seemed to me, fit into the American competitive free enterprise, freedom to speech, patent law sort of structure, which made sense, and I'm not...
I can comment on this. Bardeen and I approached Bound, and early in this stage, we were well aware that the background knowledge in this area had built up to a place where it was almost impossible for an intelligent observer very soon to make the next step. I was also aware of, in the past, the fact that several breakthroughs had been made contemporaneously in two different places, and we told Bowen that we did not want to be responsible for having the Bell Labs in the place of saying, me too. He said, well, don't worry about it. When you and Bardeen are ready to publish, we will announce it. This quieted us down, and we accepted this decision. But it was in, I think, June of January 48, that M.J. Kelly came out to the laboratories to be briefed on all the things that were going around on the laboratory. In the middle of I was at Blackboard, and in the middle of the discussion, this idea hit Kelly, right square in the... And he turned to Bowen and said, when are we going to publish this? And Bowen told him this story, and he turned to Bardeen and I and said, are you ready? And we said, yes. And so it was published in July 15th in the Physical Review.
The main delay was getting patents through. Not only had to get patents through the U.S., but introduced into all the foreign countries where he wanted to get protection. And this takes a lot of time. I was heavily involved in this because I was assigned to work with Harry Hart, who is a patent attorney on the point contact transistor. He knew nothing about semiconductors, and I knew nothing about patents, so we had to struggle along as best we could.
It is no accident that when it came time to have a historic moment at the patent office, namely the granting of the 3 millionth patent, it went to Bell Labs.
I think the policy of the Bell Lab in trying to get it introduced not only to the industrial users, but also to university people as rapidly as possible, was very helpful in spurring the development of the industry.
I think that Morton and Kelly, particularly from their writings, I didn't know either of them, understood better than most the infrastructure required for science and technology to be successful in our society. And when I spoke earlier, it was my concern over the fact that today, in government particularly, there seemed to be zero population that understands the necessary infrastructure for the survival of this country's science and technology. Are there other questions or comments?
Yes, sir. I want to comment, please. The first comment I want to make was that the idea of putting a third electrode into a semiconductor dates back to around 1925. Becker and I went through this, and so on and so forth. This particular innovation waited for an understanding, for work dedicated to understanding what was going on in these particular materials. The second thing is, we at the Bell Labs were, in essence, have always been a team. When we go to work, we receive a dollar for our patent rights. We get... But we have gotten, as far as I'm concerned, plenty of recompense.
I have one comment I'd like to make in respect to one proposal on recognition of patents in an organization. I had come to the feeling at the Bell Labs experience that any financial awards for patents would probably be an adverse thing, specific financial awards, because I've run into some cases of people who felt strongly enough about the patent situation and the recognition given for them that in a conference they would in effect clam up, not say what was occurring to them at the moment, because they would rather get off someplace and get something written down and be sure that they had a first disclosure if this happened. My feeling is that it would probably be worse in a place in which the actual specific significant financial awards were given for patents. It seems to me paying a man double time for reading patent applications, or maybe triple time, would be perfectly reasonable, because that would take the bad taste out of the mouth at the time when it's a strenuous job.
I think that there is still room for the garage-type inventor, but he's the type, I think, who recognizes a need and then perhaps very ingeniously figures out a way to get out of existing technology, but he won't create an entire new technology, which requires a much, much, much more sophisticated approach.
Legend has it that one of you three gentlemen, and I'd like to know which one, if encountered in the hallowed halls of the Bell Labs at early 48, would encounter this individual, and I'd like somebody to admit it, carrying a device, and if asked what the device was, the answer was, this is the force that will unite the Arab world.
Hey, this may be a legend, but I can enlarge on this a little bit. My first knowledge of the impact of the small battery-operated transistor radio that the Japanese sold throughout the East was when I was in Iran visiting our Peace Corps kids, and I was told that the herdsmen in Iran who followed their flocks to grazing and moved on when they grazed had battery-operated transistor radios in their tribes. And at night, the whole tribe would gather together and could listen. These were tribes that even the Shah could not yet control, but they could listen in their own language. When I was a boy, we were taught that the only hope for peace in the world was that everybody be educated to read and write. But today, if they know their own, if they can listen to their own language, they can have a choice of what they can listen to.
A figure which impresses me is that worldwide there are almost 1 billion transistor radios. Hardly anyone in the world who's not within sound of a transistor radio.
I would like to ask Drs. Shockley, Bardeen, and Bartain what their personal opinion is on the future of semiconductors. In other words, we've come 25 years since you first invented the transistor. Where are we going to go from here?
I'm just a research scientist. I don't know.
Well, I can just extrapolate from what's happened, and the rate of progress has continually amazed me as to how far they've gone. It doesn't seem to be stopped yet, but the progress is still continuing, and I expect it will for some years to come.
I've had a couple of thoughts on this that I think may be worth bringing out. One is, I think that in terms of the real impact on people, the transistor is just the tip of the iceberg is showing. And I come to this conclusion in two ways. One of them is that if you make a parallel with what happened with electricity, the first things with electricity were big power and producing very crude forms of things, crude uses of energy, lights. But if you look on further, a big thing it did was to replace the drudgery of muscles in the in electric motors. And if you go on with that, the use of the motor has gotten more and more intimate into the house. It enables you to dispose of your garbage. It does your washing. It cleans the floors, and even brushes your teeth now, or shaves you. Where the transistor comes in is it moves the role of electricity out of these. Out of the muscle and the, so to speak, art area, into the area of thinking and logic. And this role, in the home, it's come in to just a minor degree. This is one of the complex ones we have, the one that's had the biggest
two things had the biggest impact on me personally. One is the use of the tape recorder to aid memory and establish realities of what has actually been said. And the other thing is if an IBM MagnaCard typewriter with its transistorized console hadn't happened to show up at the time when we were having disruptions on campus, we didn't dare trust it in the buildings over there, so it got delivered at home, I probably wouldn't have learned how to type. One other thought on this is we know there is, if we're down to something which are in the order of a cubic micron for devices, we have sort of an existence proof in nature that we may conceivably be able to go about 10 to the ninth times farther, because that's about the scale a neuron works on. So it seems to me one can say, both in terms of applications and in terms of the potential technology, there's no reason for thinking we're approaching asymptotically anything except possibly this matter of speed of transmission.
Thank you.
If I may offer an observation here. In the previous revolution, which has been mentioned, namely the power revolution, we have attained, for example, in thermal power plants, efficiencies that are of an order one-third, say, in a good plant, of the best that can be done. In the matter of pumping information around and using the energy required to move information around, we've made calculations that indicate we are short of the ultimate limit by numbers of the order of 10 to the 20th, so that the upper limits imposed by nature on what can be done in solid-state devices are so far away from being realized that they have no impact at all upon us. It's all wide open territory. I want to express on behalf of the audience to you three our deep appreciation for the time you've spent sharing with us these fantastically exciting memories. Meeting with you.